Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin. Errol and I are both back today after about a month since our last episode, and we'll start with a quick couple of housekeeping notes. Our hiatus over the last month was not totally planned, but the result of just other things in our lives, you know, families, our day jobs, interfering with the podcast, which we do because we love it and we don't make any money on it. So looking out over the summer, you know, we'll be traveling, we'll be with our families, as many people are. We'll have some major day job commitments coming up too. So we'll be putting out new episodes every 2 to 4 weeks through June, July, and August. And we'll share a schedule on social media in the near future when those will be. This does open up some new opportunities for our listeners to contribute to what we talk about on the pod. So we'll share more about some of those channels as well in the coming weeks. But we would love to hear from you, as always, at thenewsandthebrews@gmail.com or on social media. Housekeeping note number two is a really fun one. We will be hosting our first News and Brews happy hour. It'll be in DC. Mark your calendars for Thursday, June 23rd, and more details to come on that one as well. As for today's show, a lot has happened in the last month. We will start in the UK, where the Queen celebrated her platinum jubilee while Boris Johnson is feeling maybe less than jubilant. We'll talk about two big things happening in America this week. The first public hearing from the January 6th committee in the House, which was honestly a bit of a banger, and the Summit of the Americas, which for Biden is shaping up to be whatever the opposite of a banger is. Then for our main story, we'll talk about what has been a series of horrific mass shootings in recent weeks, most prominently the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and the grocery store shooting in Buffalo, New York. And of course, we'll end with some spicy nuggets. It's great to be back talking with you. Let's get into it. Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike.
Ah, so good to be back in the saddle. Look at us.
Good to see you. We're back? Question mark.
We're back, and everything's worse.
It's a good title. How you been, man?
I've been all right. It's so for listeners, it's been a whole. Like, it's been about a month since we recorded an episode. It's been a journey. You know, most pressingly, our whole family got COVID, which, as we've been talking about with the progression of the virus, was not really a serious health concern for us as individuals. You know, I probably had it worse out of anyone in the family with like a 36-hour fever and other flu-like symptoms, but meant that we were basically between that and a vacation, we were like, with the kids constantly with limited activity options for like 3 weeks.
I love the excitement in your voice when you say that.
So that's been a focus area.
Yeah. And no, we were, I'm glad that y'all are feeling better. I'm glad that COVID, you know, is come and gone and that you got the worst of it. I'm also glad about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were out of town for a few weeks and just kind of ended up buying a house. You know, the listeners know this, the saga of buying a house. And so it's just been an incredibly busy time. And so Mike and I discussed, for listeners, we discussed whether to call this like a new season. And we were like, nah, man, we just got busy. Like, and this is our show. So, we're hoping to come back with some regularity, perhaps after the summer. I think we're going to do sort of every 3 or 4 weeks over the summer when, opportunity arises. And we've got a couple other fun things in store.
Yeah. And I'll just put out the call. If any of our listeners have thoughts on what to focus on, you know, as we are planning to record every like 3 to 4 weeks instead of every week throughout the summer, would love your input, either on our social channels, News and Brews Pod, on Instagram and Twitter, or, just reaching out to us directly. Always appreciate it.
I have a beverage. Do you have a beverage?
Of course I have a beverage.
Are you day beering?
It's not news and dry mouth, you know?
For listeners, we're recording on a Friday morning. And so I'm really anxious to see what Mike has. Ready, go.
My 10 a.m. brew of choice today is a Wandering Bear cold brew coffee.
Nice. That's your like coffee in a box that you get?
Yes. I don't actually subscribe, but you can subscribe. They send it to your house. I think I've had it before, maybe on the show, but it's been a big joy in my life for the last 18 months or so.
It looks delightfully caramel colored.
Yeah, it's nice and strong. That's the biggest thing.
That's good.
And, you know, just on tap in the fridge, pour a little milk in there, set for the day.
Great. You like your coffee like you like your women, tall and strong?
that's woman singular, but yes.
Woman, yes. Fair enough. I've got a San Pellegrino Limonata Organic. Italian sparkling drinks, and don't let the San Pellegrino fool you. This is got a lot of sugar in it.
Yeah. Those things are great because they're like so sweet, but they have the San Pellegrino logo. So they're like so acceptable for adults to take in, you know?
Yeah, no, it's basically I'm drinking like a juice box, but in a fancier container. All right. Well, shall we get to it?
Yeah. Let's talk about the news.
Let's start this week across the pond with our special relationship friends. It was a big week in Britain. First of all, Queen Elizabeth was feted for completing her 70th year as queen. 70 years she's been queen. She became queen in her 20s under tough circumstances, which of course I know because I'm an expert in all things Queen Elizabeth because I watched the first season of The Crown. I tend to be bad at math, but I think that officially makes her pretty old.
At least like 65, right?
Yeah. I mean, if she was like became queen as a twinkle in an eye, then yeah, that math would work. Yeah. She's been queen a long time. She's seen a lot and sort of navigated Britain through a lot. And whether you love or hate the royalty situation in Great Britain, you have to respect the longevity and the continued just really excellent wave that Queen Elizabeth, you know, goes about her daily life. And for those that are interested, which I know you are, Mike, as a People magazine subscriber, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle did attend some of the Diamond Jubilee celebrations. And perhaps more importantly for some, Prince William and Kate's kids were pretty darn cute.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the sum there. I didn't take in much of the Diamond Jubilee content. My business partner, my day job is actually from London. And as I told him, you know, like we won some wars, so I don't have to pay attention to this stuff. But the viral video of William and Kate's youngest, it's their four-year-old whose name is Lewis, just being like such a little shit to his mom, particularly on the heels of a COVID experience with our 5 and 3 and 3 month old. It was really just highly relatable content. You got to appreciate it.
That's what the royal family is known for.
Yeah.
Highly relatable content. I did like the planes flying over. Did you see this in the shape of a 70?
No.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So in other British news, friend of the pod, British Prime Minister Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, about whom Adam Taylor of the Washington Post said he was, quote, dismissed as the clown prince of British politics for decades, which he's not calling Boris Johnson the clown prince, but he's sort of saying that other people are. And in so doing, I thought it was really a nice kind of phrase.
Yeah. Once in future, right?
Once in future. So anyways, Bojo faced a vote of no confidence in Parliament. And this is particularly interesting because it comes less than 3 years after he was kind of hailed as the next big thing in British politics because he secured a huge majority for his Conservative Party back in December 2019. So why did this vote of no confidence happen? Well, because some of the same people who rode to power on his coattails now say his behavior in several scandals was, quote, insults the electorate. News and Brews pod listeners will remember that such classics as the multiple ruckus parties at 10 Downing Street, this is not just like a one-off thing, that happened during COVID lockdowns. He lavishly refurbished his apartment at 11 Downing Street. And the third reason, perhaps maybe the most real reason, is the Tories got an absolute shellacking in local elections in early May, so last month of this year. Mm-hmm. So despite all this, Boris Johnson did survive. He is still the prime minister. A vote of no confidence is still a vote. And he still got 148 out of 359 conservative MPs. So 41% of his own party voted against him in this vote of no confidence.
Yeah. And so he did survive and, you know, put out some statements with like sort of a who are you trying to convince vibe about how convincing that win was for him. I think for observers of British politics, the mere fact of this vote is sort of seen as the beginning of the end. There's, I think, a long history of British prime ministers surviving no confidence votes only to shortly thereafter be properly ousted from power. It's what happened with Theresa May. It's what happened with John Major. Now, Boris Johnson is not those people and is incapable of shame. So who knows what'll happen, but not a great couple of weeks for him.
Definitely not.
So let's move back to this side of the pond, because if you think partying is insulting to the electorate, wait until you hear about insurrections and rioting. On Thursday of this week, in prime time, that's that Thursday night Seinfeld slot, Errol.
Major.
The January 6th committee in the House held the first of several public and televised hearings it will hold throughout June and July. This first hearing comes amid a clear uptick in revelations and other activity relating to January 6th in general. So I'll set a little bit of that context. This week, it emerged that the Proud Boys coordinated with the Oath Keepers to be sort of the tip of the spear in the insurrection effort, driving the first confrontations with Capitol Police, the first breaches of police barricades, the first breach of the Capitol building itself. The Proud Boys actually joined the Oath Keepers this week in being charged with seditious conspiracy, which is the most serious charge DOJ has levied to date around January 6th. It's a federal crime that carries up to 20 years in prison.
If this wasn't so serious, I'd feel like that description is like some sort of video game, like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and they're like insurrecting and there's barriers and stuff. But yeah, no, some pretty serious shit.
It's almost like both video games and these ideologies are aimed at a similar group of people. I don't know.
Who knew?
Meanwhile, details about just how expansive and really thorough Trump's plan to overturn the election was are starting to become clearer. So you heard this a little bit in the hearing. I'll refer to last night since we're recording this Friday morning, but the first hearing, Liz Cheney signaled in her opening remarks that they have proof of Trump engaging in a 7-part plan to overturn the election. Last week, we learned that aides to Vice President Mike Pence warned the Secret Service the night before January 6th that his life could be in danger. So a lot more to unravel there. And because this is a story about the Trump administration, these very serious revelations have been paired like right next to total clownery, right? Like a real like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito twins situation.
Do tell.
You have Peter Navarro getting busted by the FBI, whining about it very publicly, and then just digging himself in deeper, trying to represent himself at the hearing in front of the judge. You have Rudy Giuliani getting an email from a guy literally named Kenneth Cheesebro, whose big idea, in the wake of the election was to have Chuck Grassley preside over the electoral count and steal the election that way. All to say, the drumbeat has been building. Now, the hearing itself, which like all of them was produced by former ABC News President James Goldston, seemed designed to say, I'm not like all the other hearings. I'm a cool hearing. You just saw brief opening statements from the chair of the committee, Benny Thompson, and from Liz Cheney, the senior Republican on the committee, instead of sort of doing the whole like lineup of everyone trying to get their clip for their social media account. Lots of well-produced video content throughout, video of direct testimony from well-known, really famous witnesses, and what I would call a drip tease of news revelations.
Yeah.
So did you watch the hearing, by the way?
I watched like the latter half of it. I've been watching Superstore on.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's a fun show. And so like after a long day, I was like hearing Superstore. But then I was like, you know what? I'm an American. I need I need to turn this on. So I did catch the second half of it and would agree with the takes on sort of like the drip, drip, drip of disclosures. I'm very interested to see what Liz Cheney has in her back pocket, because there was lots of like more to come on this.
Do you worry that announcing that for you, Errol, is compromising your brand as a coastal elite?
Announcing what? That I
like Superstore? That you watch Superstore instead of The Hearing?
Oh, I don't know. I think it like, yeah, maybe it compromises my status as a coastal elite, but it's like, you know, gets me with, as I sit here wearing a cufflinks and a tie, it really gets me, you know, in tune with what's going on in non-coastal
Don't worry.
America.
More stories to come on this pod. On that drip tease, some of what we learned in the first hearing, which I did watch and have lots of thoughts on that I'll share literally right now. So several cabinet officials were seriously considering invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump as president, as he just generally flailed about after losing the election. So Sean Hannity actually confirmed this in a text message exchange with Kayleigh McEnany that the committee showed on the screen during the hearing. And then outside of the hearing, Betsy DeVos, Trump's education secretary, confirmed on Thursday that she was one of those cabinet officials who seriously considered the 25th Amendment before she decided to resign on January 7th. They showed a video. The leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers actually met in a garage in DC the night before January 6th to coordinate their strategy for the following day. So that was new, and that was...
I hadn't heard about that. That's definitely new.
Yep. Trump himself was completely on board with the idea of hanging Mike Pence. This is not at all surprising, but is much more detailed and much more clear. And we've got direct quotes now. So he said, as the rioters were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," Trump reportedly said, "Maybe our supporters have the right idea and Mike Pence deserves it."
Yeah. Are we talking about like actual hanging, or is this like a metaphorical hanging, or does it matter?
Well, I don't know how metaphorical it can be when you're like literally constructing a gallows on the Mall. I don't know if this is a crowd known for its subtlety, but I think it's fair to say that they meant something specific with the word hang.
Yeah. No, I mean, Mike Pence was probably right to feel like he was in danger.
Yeah. Like it could be like hang with Mike Pence, but like, I don't think ever in his life, someone has like actually wanted to hang out with that guy.
Yeah. There's a kid's book about this. Marlon Bundo.
A couple of them, actually. The biggest revelation of the night, I thought, was that several Republican members of Congress asked Trump for pardons. So Liz Cheney named one representative from Pennsylvania and suggested there are several others. That is a spicy nugget right there, as we would say at News and Brews.
Copyright.
And I thought it was really the best example of this drip tease of news. It's something people will be wondering about, like who was it, speculating, you know, a lot of members will get asked about it. This one also had an immediate impact on social media. So the House Judiciary Committee Republicans Twitter account put out a snarky tweet like early in the hearing saying that there was nothing new coming out. Now, ironically, that account is run by Jim Jordan, who's currently disobeying subpoenas to help the committee uncover information. But there was just a series of pretty epic and satisfying dunks on that tweet by the end of the hearing, as it actually became clear that there was a lot of new revelations. I think that none of that really gets to the question of like, what is this all for?
Yeah.
And I think there are really three goals. If I were the committee, three goals that I would have. The first is this is happening in Congress, right? We want to get some new legislation out of this, and legislation specifically to make sure this can't happen again. I think there's been some disagreement within the committee on how ambitious they should be around this. You know, if you remember, after coming to power, the current democratically controlled House passed the For the People Act, which would have made a wide range of election reforms. I think that's unlikely, but you know, sort of where on the spectrum from preventing this one specific move in Congress to block the count of votes or corrupt the count of votes, Two, let's overhaul our whole election system, I think is still kind of open where they might go with that.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. It's like, what is legislation actually going to do to, in the moment, from a tactical perspective, like stop what happened?
Yeah.
Like, you know, fund more Capitol Police officers or something. Like, the legislation that is needed is to strengthen our democracy.
Right. And so there is some noise coming out of the Senate on that this week. On Wednesday, a bipartisan group of lawmakers who have been working for months on legislation met again. That legislation would amend the Electoral Count Act to restrain the vice president's role formally. It would raise the congressional threshold for objecting to electoral votes. It would overhaul the transition process, and it would protect election officials from threats. So they met and, you know, coming out of the meeting, started like playing the happy music, you know, like the marketplace on NPR style, like we think things are good today noises. Susan Collins said, we have resolved a lot of issues, but we have some more work to do, which I hope we'll finish up this week. Jeanne Shaheen was standing next to her and agreed. Chris Coons says he's hopeful and expects the public hearings will add some extra energy to the bipartisan group. So listeners, as you've been conditioned, whenever you start to feel hopeful about bipartisan cooperation to do the right thing in the Senate, go bang your head on the wall for 15 to 20 minutes, however long you need to bring on the general numbness.
Come on, Mike. You gotta have some. Gotta have some hope. Come on.
So that's audience number one, right? Is the rest of Congress, and if there's a process underway, I could well see, you know, this kind of a hearing, regardless of how they approach it. You know, just that's an audience, Congress, that pays attention to congressional hearings. So you could have a sympathetic audience there. The second goal would be around criminal action. Right. And that's sort of the founding charge of the committee itself, right, is to make recommendations to the DOJ. Attorney General Merrick Garland, a tortoise, really, in a world full of rabid hares, has said he'll be watching the hearings. And as I mentioned, we have seen some more action coming out of DOJ, including that indictment of Proud Boys leaders earlier this week. And a general sense that, you know, they may be moving closer to the strategy, the conspiracy, the leadership behind the attempted coup. So
I kind of like our attorney general is a tortoise, you know, slow and steady wins the race kind of deal. Like he strikes me as very like deliberate and like small C cautious, right? Like, you know, wants to make sure that things are really solid before moving forward. So
I think we can award him big C cautious. After all
Big
this
C
time,
cautious?
Yeah, it's been like a year and a half.
Okay, all right, fine.
No, I certainly get the position that he and DOJ more broadly is in, right? I mean, Biden came in with a pledge to take the politics out of DOJ and was immediately, before being inaugurated, presented with you know, maybe the worst set of crimes ever committed by a president from his immediate predecessor right at the end of his term. And so it's a fine line to walk.
I don't know, man. Are we really getting into the, like, is he as bad as Nixon game here? Maybe that's another podcast episode.
There's a lot more time missing on the tapes for Trump, right? Like 7 hours as opposed to, yeah. So anyway, so that's, I think those are really the two main audiences for this hearing, right? Are the rest of Congress and then DOJ. The third would be the public. And we are, as listeners know, in an election year. We're about 5 months away from election day right now. You could see some hope that, you know, a hearing like this would clarify the stakes for voters across the country in the decision around who to put in charge of Congress this year. I think expectations around how much a congressional hearing will move the public should be low. Not sure quite how that squares with January 6th committee member Jamie Raskin saying this week that the hearings will, quote, blow the roof off the House, end quote.
Yeah.
And even if they do make an impact, like election day is in 5 months, do you know what we were talking about 5 months ago?
I don't.
What if I give you a hint and say it was a court trial?
I'm still lost.
Yeah. So there you go. It was the Elizabeth Holmes trial.
Oh, Theranos. Yeah. RIP.
But there's like that rule of 90 in American politics. 90% of people forget 90% of what happens within 90 days. So I think, you know, there's only so much you can do.
I just wonder how much of this is going to have legs. Like there's sort of, And we're going to get to some of this a little bit later in the episode, but there's several major things going on, right? Like the war in Ukraine is still going on. We've got inflation is still a big thing. Mm-hmm. We've got guns now in the headlines. We've got the Roe v. Wade stuff that you talked about in your special episode a few weeks ago. And I'm not sure how much of that benefits Democrats versus Republicans, but mm-hmm. I think there's like this concoction or this sort of mix of stuff that maybe sequentially or one after the other, whatever, will have like that 90-90-90 thing. And it's sort of like whichever one comes to the fore before the election is the one that has the most impact. But who knows? I mean, people are also going to be early voting and voting by mail. And so the election is sort of drawn out a little bit more. So maybe this sort of lead up to election day itself matters a little bit less, but great points, Mike.
Yeah. The one other thing I'll say, just having watched it firsthand, is it's kind of good TV.
Yeah. That's what they wanted you to think.
No, it's very, very purposeful, but like my review from a purely entertainment perspective is that this hearing is like Law and Order meets Jeopardy.
Really?
So like the Law and Order vibe, I think, is quite intentional. There's a real flow between, you know, produced scenes in videos that they're entering into evidence, testimony that they're playing live from in this first hearing. It was people like Bill Barr saying that he told the president directly all the election lies were bullshit. Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, people whose faces everyone knows, people who are famous, right? And then they would sort of also allow you to hear the case directly from the lawyers who have been preparing it, right? So one of the videos they showed and entered into evidence was a prosecutor who works for the committee just laying out the case with like interactive graphics around the timeline and how the Capitol grounds were breached and what was happening in different places at different times. So very like Law and Order or like high publicity trial vibes to it. But the Jeopardy part, I think, is more of an accidental delight, because like all of Trump's crimes were so out in the open that when you see them start to lay it out, you're like, I know this one. You're like, what is deputizing violent far right groups as a new age brown shirt at the direction of the president's reelection campaign for 1,000?
I was going to ask if like all the witnesses just responded to all the questions with a question or something.
Well, so they had a couple of witnesses. They had a Capitol Police officer and the documentarian who was embedded with the Proud Boys.
Yeah, that's the part that I watched.
But a lot of what they were showing was testimony from months ago. I mean, not totally unlike the Depp Heard trial, actually, where a lot of the exhibits being entered into evidence are depositions. But in this case, it's you know, people you know saying things that are new and in some cases pretty damning to you know, the perpetrators of the coup.
Do we know anything about the ratings of this? Just getting back to your, like, this is good TV point.
Not yet, as far as I don't know. I haven't honestly looked this morning. You know, the it happened last night. I haven't looked this morning for that.
Yeah, I'd be interested because Fox didn't run it, right, which means half of the country didn't see it.
Well, I mean, that's an exaggeration, right? Tucker Carlson has the most watched.
I never exaggerated. I never exaggerate, Mike.
He gets like 3 million viewers, which, I mean, is a lot, but that's not half the country.
Yeah, that's fair. They didn't show it though, right? They showed, it was like Tucker's show was on last night.
So I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
I think that the other thing about the content and to the point that this is actually not just good TV, because good TV in 2022 only gets you so far. It's also designed to be shareable outside of the hearing, right? As I mentioned, a lot of their exhibits were like a series of videos with pretty high production value. Every video shown is being quickly posted to social media by the committee. Mm. What will be interesting to see, I think this is sort of the big question on how much impact this makes with the public, is does any of this take on a life of its own outside owned media channels or you know, news networks? Like, does this take on a Depp Heard trial vibe with viral amplification on TikTok and other social networks? I think that really will determine whether this makes any sort of lasting impact on public sentiment.
Interesting. So were they appealing to like the Gen Z types, do you think?
Well, I think it's more a question of how than what, almost, in my mind. Like, because you need content creators and people who are interested to be sort of taking this over.
Yeah.
Right. So I think to the point about the format that this was presented in and the way in which the content has been kind of broken up and put out piecemeal, I think is intended to prompt that sharing. I think it's, but it's like a, almost like an anthropological or sociological, it's like a cultural question of like, does this end up catching fire online and with the kids, with the youth? No cap, Errol.
Yeah, I mean, they should have maybe just put it on their MySpace page and called it a day, but this is probably a better way of going about
it. Yeah. For its part, the right is clearly freaked out by this. Fox News, as you called out, is the only major cable news network not carrying the hearing live and really the series of hearings. People from the Trump Fox industrial complex were teasing that there would be aggressive counter-programming that would try to, you know, wrench the narrative away from Liz Cheney's icy fingers. But on the first night, that counter-programming amounted to Tucker Carlson's regular show, just without commercials, so viewers would have no opportunity to absentmindedly channel surf over to the hearing.
Which was on literally every other channel.
Right. So on Tucker Carlson's show, they did stream in clips from the hearing to like play in the background behind whoever Carlson was interviewing, who probably was involved. But when the hearing video clips started to get to showing serious violence from the Capitol riot, they replaced it with like B-roll from the opening of the hearing.
Oh, interesting.
So there's, I'll share this in the show notes. Someone on Twitter saw this and put a side-by-side of what was being shown live at the hearing versus what was being shown in the background of Carlson's show. And you see the moment when they realize, you know, the Tucker Carlson producers realize like, this video is going to show some bad stuff, and just cut away from it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're going to be freaked out if, getting back to your previous point about virality, if it actually like shows that it has some legs and people start, you know, asking hard questions that these, some of these members of Congress and others on the right don't have good answers for. And if this ends up going away, and by the third episode of this, we only have CNN carrying it versus like all the networks, then mm-hmm. like, you know, maybe they won't be as afraid, but I think a lot remains to be seen on how much this is able to have legs.
Yep. And bigger picture, like, I'm not so sure it's a good thing to professionalize the spectacle of congressional hearings. Like, of course, I think these hearings have particularly noble motivations. I think this is really important. But it also represents an escalation in like the information warfare arms race, right? And when Republicans control Congress and they find their next Benghazi, do we really want them bringing in like an intact Fox News or History Channel Ancient Aliens production team to make it sparkle?
I mean, counterpoint, they're going to do it anyways.
Well, but they haven't, right? Like, the Benghazi hearings were famously like watching paint dry on a wall. Right. I think this is a new level of production value and spectacle, true spectacle, to bring into a congressional hearing.
But I think that's sort of making the argument that this committee, which is bipartisan, but in large part populated by Democrats, is sort of opening a can of worms and changing the game here. And I would say, like, If Republicans thought this was actually going to be useful, they may not have done it for Benghazi, but that was really the beginning of this sort of shift in narrative creation and content creation and sort of anger, maybe, question mark, that has really grown and grown and grown through the Trump years and beyond. And so I think there's like, they would probably in today's day and age do this anyways. Are they going to get some tips on like how to do it, you know, smoothly? Maybe, but they probably had those skills anyway.
Yeah, my mind can't help but wander to like a committee full of literal conspiracy theorists like putting together the best conspiracy theory teasers they possibly can and putting that out to a nationwide audience under the imprimatur of a well-produced congressional hearing. Now, as with most things that Democrats in Congress do, I'll just check myself and say, like, the root cause of the problem is that there is one party full of nihilist hucksters. And, you know, we Democrats can't like stop themselves from communicating clearly and well out of fear that the other side will do it dishonestly, right? So overall, I think it the first hearing made me more hopeful that there could be an impact on public opinion than I was going in, markedly so. But just kind of want to also be aware of long-term implications.
So speaking of production value, let's fly from the U.S. Congress over to Los Angeles, where the United States and thus President Joe Biden is currently hosting the 9th Summit of Americas. This is a little known, except you're like, wait, what? This is happening? What is this thing? So this is a periodically organized international summit. And Lord knows we love summitry here on News and Brews.
So good.
That brings together leaders of countries that are members of the Organization of American States, another organization where lots of people are like, wait, what? That's a thing? It's sort of like the African Union or ASEAN in Southeast Asia. Little bit less of a, you know, EU is sort of an extreme example. There are lots more coordination in the EU, but it's kind of like this, we're better off together. We should have an organization where we come together regularly. And that's what the OAS is, the Organization of American States. And they periodically every 3 or 4 years host this Summit of the Americas. And so this time it's in LA. And it basically is supposed to, these summits are supposed to include all the countries in the Western Hemisphere. And I think would have, except there's a few that didn't come, and I'll get to that in a second. So here's, before I get to that point, here's what the Biden-Harris administration wants you to know about the summit. First of all, have you been following this at all, Mike?
Casually.
Casually. As a news bruiser.
Yes.
Great.
More than I followed the Platinum Jubilee.
Fair enough. I have lots of people who are like super into the Platinum Jubilee. There's like a surprising amount of Americans who are like royalists.
I know.
Maybe like small R royalists. Okay. So here's what they want you to know. The Western Hemisphere is the most democratic hemisphere in the world, according to President Biden's speech. And there's no reason why it can't be even more democratic over the next 10 years. The U.S. is back. You know, we're not just building back the U.S. better, but we're back diplomatically. We've been hearing this sort of coming out of the White House since the beginning of the Biden administration. And it's quite frankly great to hear that the U.S. is back in the Western Hemisphere leadership game. After years of neglect under President Trump, everything was about China. Everything, like, we didn't care about the Western Hemisphere except, you know, when it was Trump and Bolsonaro or buddies, which I'll get to in a second. In terms of priorities, you know, all of these summits come with priorities, and I'm sure there will be a communique, and we also love communiques here on News and Brews.
Let's take bets on the over under page number of the communique. I think 56.
Ooh, I was going to go with 62. Let's come back to this later. That's good. So the priorities for Biden, at least, which is not necessarily the priorities of all the countries in the region, but the host gets to sort of set the priorities. And so loosely, it's economic recovery from COVID. We're talking about supply chains and trade and sort of nearshoring some of our supply chains. And this is in really basic terms, like, let's move those factories that have been in China and Vietnam. Let's move them to Mexico and Honduras and Guatemala. He talked about combating food insecurity. He talked about health system strengthening to prevent future pandemics. He talked about climate change, especially with the Caribbean islands, who are disproportionately negatively affected by the increased frequency and veracity of climate events. They talked about a, quote, groundbreaking integrated new approach to migration management, which I look forward to digging into as part of my day job.
Always on caravans.
Always on caravans all the time. Color me skeptical. That's color with a U. I'm harping back to our British friends. Color me a little bit skeptical. And like I said, democracy is back on the agenda. So that's, I think, what President Joe Biden would have liked to us to be talking about here, which leads me to what everyone is actually talking about. So the U.S. excluded Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela from the summit, basically because they're governed by autocratic regimes. In protest, the leaders of Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Bolivia all boycotted the summit. Mexico being the most significant of those, you know, to and getting the most attention that they boycotted. Even those that did show up, like the Prime Minister of Belize and the Argentine president, they basically all lamented the absence of the other three countries. Sometimes, like, Joe Biden was sitting in the front row and they were like, this is not right. They should be here. So that's, I think, taking up, that's sort of the root of what the news coverage has been.
So do you understand the administration's rationale for excluding those countries? I cannot put it together.
So no, is the short answer. My guess is it's some combination of politics and, you know, wanting to really make a statement about democracy.
And that's like the John Madden take. This decision came down to politics and making statements.
I mean, look, I don't have any insider baseball knowledge about this, but, you know, Democrats would like to win Florida again. And, you know, like, coming down hard on Cuba is maybe not the worst way of getting votes in Cuba. Now, I have issues with it, you know, personally, with our Cuba policy, et cetera. Nicaragua has just been a really terrible place recently. And Venezuela obviously has precipitated the largest displacement crisis in our hemisphere, probably in the hemisphere's history. So, like, there's good reasons why I think these leaders were considered for exclusion, but it's a bit like the UN, where, I mean, the Organization of American States is not the United Nations, but like, we agreed to host the United Nations in New York on the Lower East Side because we wanted to be the venue for this, which means that, like, leaders of countries that are not actually allowed, Iran, for example, that are not actually allowed to come to the United States, can come to the United Nations. And that's just sort of like, you know, the price that we pay, or the, you know, what we have to do as the host. And so I think they could have taken that similar tact.
Yeah, I take your point about the politics of it. And, like, if that's the reality, and, you know, we just can't afford one more short-term hit to electoral prospects in November, like, that's a lump. But, like, the making a statement, here's the problem with using this as a statement about our democratic principles, is it then opens up Biden and the administration to charges of rank hypocrisy if they do anything that is not consistent with those values. Like, if you're going to make a statement here, you can't announce in the same week that you're going to visit Saudi Arabia.
Which is, of course, what everybody's talking about. And this is exactly what the leaders of Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela and China would like to talk about, you know. And I think the people who are making these decisions are, I would hope, weighing the benefits and drawbacks in terms of, you know, does this create a new opportunity for China, not just in those three countries, but also sort of throughout the region. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of this is like 19-dimensional chess when it really comes down to personalities, but I do think it was a significant decision that I think justifiably so has resulted in the coverage of the Summit on Americas being about anything other than what the Biden administration wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Should we move on to our main story?
Let's.
So over the past month or so, you know, Mike, we have texted and we have, you know, debated whether or not to do even with our travels and COVID and other things, whether to do an episode. And I think we got the closest to doing one after Buffalo and Uvalde.
Yeah.
And the shootings there. And I think it was just because part of this exercise of hosting a podcast with you is I really love talking about the news with you. I love hearing your takes, but it's also, there's an element of catharsis here, at least for me. And shootings in general are hard for me. I'm not a gun owner. I'm not a fan of guns. I've lived and worked in Iraq and Afghanistan and South Sudan and some very heavily sort of gun heavy places. And I've never been a fan. In particular, it gets me when there are children involved. And I think this always hit me hard. Obviously it hits harder now that I have kids.
Yep.
So just briefly, and then I would love to get your kind of how you're thinking about what's going on and takes. There have been 296 mass shootings as defined by like four or more people get shot already in 2022. That's 296 in the first 160 days of 2022. Again, I'm not good at math, but that's over one and slightly less than two per day.
Yep.
And so I think we have had a problem for a long time. And it's when things like what happened in Uvalde and Buffalo happen, I think it is yet another opportunity for us to consider how broken our system is, that we can't protect children while they're at elementary school.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I agree with all of that. I think, I found this story really hard to follow, not because it's like overly complex, but just emotionally. Like, it's just so much terror and grief and tragedy to take in. And this sort of thing has definitely gotten worse since I've become a parent. To put a fine point on the stats you mentioned, the Uvalde shooting happened on May 24th. As we record, that 17 days ago. In those 17 days, according to the Gun Violence Archive, we've had 41 more mass shootings in America. And, you know, as I follow the aftermath, and I think just horrific details coming out, you know, I would recommend Matthew McConaughey's speech in Washington that brought it into very personal and visual and concrete terms. And as we've learned more about the just horrific ineptitude or corruption or something else from the police who responded to the shooting and the missed opportunity to have this be, you know, to save some of those kids. I've been trying to like capture or just notice what I'm feeling. And I don't think it's numbness. Like, I'm definitely feeling a visceral and emotional reaction to this, but this has just happened so much throughout our lives.
Yeah.
Going back to Columbine in the late 90s, there's like a forced compartmentalization, I think, where like it's just, I'm almost like conditioned to keep it off the front burners. No matter how hurt or outraged or scared you are, like doing the same things we did after Sandy Hook or after Parkland or after any number of these other tragedies starts to feel like a totally satisfaction-free exercise of screaming into the void.
Yeah. Even before Uvalde, which Matthew McConaughey is from Uvalde, and I would also second that press briefing that he did. And I think the White House, to their credit, has done a good job of, you know, if this is the White House press secretary up there talking about that, or even the president, you're going to get kind of similar audiences, slightly larger audiences. But when you have Matthew McConaughey sort of originally from Uvalde, you know, showing up green Converse sneakers that have a heart, you know, colored on the toe, that elicits a different reaction. And getting back to your January 6th hearing point, like actually is sort of more useful in terms of kind of getting, like, I saw this across platforms. Mm-hmm. This is what the news focused on, you know, and they may not have focused as much if it was just a member of the administration. They did, as an aside, they did this with Asian hate recently. They had BTS, the, you know, South Korean mega star boy band group, at the White House. And it was like, I think the most watched White House video ever or something, which is not surprising. But I would agree in terms of like, it's not numbness. I think for me, it's anger, and it's, I'm trying not to make the anger bleed over into resignation because like, of course, when many people die in Buffalo and there's children that die, like, of course, that grabs the headlines for a short amount of time. And then January 6th committee happens. And then, you know, we Roe v. Wade, something happened. And it's just like you said, we sort of move on. And in a way, I think that's why I'm a little skeptical that anything will change, because it's the current state of our, not just our politics, but the framing around politics. And so this is where like my brain, since I'm not an overly emotional person, like having a strong emotional reaction is uncomfortable for me. And so I tend to go into this like analysis space. And I just want to shout out Office Hours with Karp and Loge is another podcast that Alon and Evans produces. And it's these two strategic communications experts. And they had a really good rundown on their last episode. They were sort of talking about this from a strategic communications perspective. And they both come from sort of left of center viewpoints. But I think Dave Karp especially it was really useful to me. And so to summarize inadequately what he was saying, I will link it in the show notes, but he was basically pointing out that the current framing is, are you for or against the Second Amendment of the Constitution? And under that framing, which is what the NRA and a lot of members of Congress want you to think that that is the question. Under that framing, even people who are appalled by 19 elementary school students and two teachers being mowed down with a military-style automatic rifle, even those people might say, yeah, it's terrible, but I support the right of people to bear arms because I'm in support of the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
Of course, that's the wrong framing.
Yeah.
Right. But that's what they have been going for years. And I think it's a key point of like why they have been getting victory after victory for decades. And by victory, I mean zero action.
And there's a real legal underpinning to it as well. Right. Like, I don't think I really appreciated before kind of catching up on some of this stuff in the current news environment, but the District of Columbia versus Heller decision, right? The 2008, you know, Scalia-driven interpretation of the Second Amendment as universally focusing on an individual's right to bear arms was quite radical and out of step with the legal traditions of the United States.
Yeah.
And requires a willful ignorance of the entire first half of the amendment and an entire ignorance of the historical context around what the role of militias were in the early republic. That actually, while being hugely depressing, also carries a kernel of hope in it, because there's nothing that says that that is the interpretation that has to hold in, for the next generation of, you know, Supreme Court jurisprudence and you know, general interpretation of the Constitution, right? That it's a long game to play, and it feels like the deck is stacked against those who believe in gun control. And that being said, there's a mechanism there to make things better.
I think that's right. And I mean, the Second Amendment talks about well-regulated militias. And so this legal argument is about like, what does that mean? What does well-regulated mean?
Right.
And in Texas, that means it's harder to sell a taco than it is to buy a gun, or harder to sell a taco than it is to sell a gun. And I think so there's certainly like legal arguments to be made about what founders' intent was. I go back and forth on whether we should even be talking about the Second Amendment. It's sort of like, do you play this game and try to win on their terms by talking about what is a well-regulated militia mean, or by like, hey, the founders wouldn't be cool with like 19 kids being mowed down by military style weapons. Like, that's not a thing that they would have wanted. Or do you just try to reframe the conversation to be literally anything other than that? Like, let's talk about gun violence prevention or protecting children's lives, or how to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally unstable people that seem to be the problem for some, you know, people. Then at least we'd have a starting point that wasn't binary. That wasn't like, are you with us or against us on the Second Amendment?
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally buy that from a strategic communications perspective. From both a legal perspective, though, and I think from like an intellectual honesty perspective, we have to take it on. And I'll share in the show notes, Paul Post, one of our favorite historians, had a great Twitter thread about this. I guess he's an IR expert more than a historian. But talking about that context of militias in the early republic being the only standing army that the founders intended to allow.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it was really important to remove any restrictions that you may place on states in arming and standing up militia. That was necessary to get the states to buy into the whole idea of a constitution. And so, you know, all of that changed many times over, most pointedly around the end of the Civil War. And obviously we maintain a quite sizable standing army today. And so the context is really important to understand what the founders actually meant with the Second Amendment. And it sort of is necessary to make sense of the two clauses.
I agree. And I think this is a yes and situation rather than either or, right? Like right now, the Supreme Court is certainly skews ideologically right of center, and who knows what they're going to do. But I have very little trust that in the immediate future, there's going to be anything to overturn Scalia's interpretation from, you know, the late 2000s. So I think those battles are really, really important, and we need to continue to wage them and get clarity on sort of what we mean and what is meant by and what should be the sort of legal underpinning. At the same time, you have to change the public narrative around this, because the inactivity in Congress, because Congress can do a lot. This is not all up to nine people that sit on the Supreme Court, right? Like the Congress can, and I would of course argue should, do something to limit the ability of bad actors to have military grade weaponry. And I think that's why it needs to be this sort of push. Communications is maybe like it sort of undervalues it or whatever. It just needs to be a change in how we think about this. And ultimately, I mean, we talked about the midterm elections before. Ultimately, there have to be electoral consequences for people. And right now, that's also trending in the wrong direction. There was, I don't know if you saw this, but there was this Republican member of Congress from New York who, after Buffalo, was like, yeah, we should do something about this. And he got pushed out of his primary and is no longer running for re-election. Yeah. So
I mean, there have been glimmers, is maybe too strong a word, glints of hope coming out of Congress that like a much too restrained gun control bill may pass the Senate. But that again requires actual bipartisan cooperation 5 months before an election. So take the appropriate head to wall precautions as you follow that story.
Yeah, I would agree with that in timing wise. But, you know, I think there is lots of anxiety. There's lots of anger in the public. And I think that the public can and should be demanding more, whether that comes in the next 5 months or not. Like, basically, everybody is assuming that the Democrats will lose the House and or the Senate in the midterms. And so let's say one of those things doesn't happen, you know, do we interpret this as a renewed mandate to do something about this? And we start looking at, you know, really serious limitations on, you know, not limitations, but just like background checks. Like, you know, I've got people in my own family who own guns and believe that they should have the right to own guns that really would like for it to be harder for other people to get guns.
Yeah.
Right. Because you know, I won't mention the members of my family, but some people I'm very close to are like really, really well trained on, you know, how to handle weaponry and how to store it safely. And like, that's not what we're talking about here. Like, those are the people that almost need to be like, yeah, let's make it harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Which you have heard some of. There has been, I mean, it's like been almost reduced to the point of a hashtag at this point, but there has been some feeling that this time is different.
McConaughey talked about this at the White House too. Yeah. Like Uvalde, Texas is like a pretty rural part of Texas. There's lots of guns there. It's like not going to take all the guns away. Although Justin Trudeau is trying to do that in Canada, but you know, that's not the goal here. The goal is just to make it, you know, a little bit harder and have that be like, let's take that win. Yeah. Right. And let's build off that win. And in doing so, maybe move away from this sort of binary portrayal of, are you with us or against us on the Second Amendment?
Totally. And on electoral implications and on, you know, public action, Bernie Sanders proposed earlier this week that the Democrats develop a Contract with America style agenda that can be easily communicated about what they will do if they get expanded majorities and are able to actually drive an agenda in Congress. That strikes me as an excellent idea. And I think making gun control one of the cornerstones of that, given that it's like a 75% favorable set of issues among the public, I think makes a lot of sense. In terms of what we can actually do this Saturday, June 11th, March for Our Lives is organizing a nationwide series of protests. If you're in DC, it starts at noon at the Washington Monument. And you can find more information, sign up at marchforourlives.com.
Shall we get to some spicy nuggets?
Let's. No, you go first. Why don't you go first?
Oh, that's so nice. Okay. So during the sort of 2020 election, and I'll continue it into early 2021, basically until Inauguration Day, I feel like Twitter doom scrolling was like a thing that we all did. And then there was like this period of sort of happiness and like maybe things are going to get better. And then as things, you know, go down, long story short, we're back in the doom scrolling territory. And so as I was doom scrolling, I came across, and it was a friend of mine who highlighted this, I came across this tweet thread that is just absolutely a joy. Mm-hmm. And the first tweet says, it's by this guy named Brandon, who you find out later is LGBT New Yorker. And he says, I'm watching When Harry Met Sally for the first time while doing a little admin. Mm-hmm. And my thoughts so far are, and he goes on, and I lost count of like how many tweets there are, but he basically screenshots When Harry Met Sally and just has the best, most wholesome takes ever on it's like a little bit of like a Gen Z, you know, kind of like, I need a sweater and I need to be sitting in a New York library. Like, what am I doing with my life? Kind of, you know, and he, like Meg Ryan is captured here on one of the tweets, and in all caps, he goes, the dueling sweaters, the light in her hair, the film cinematography, it's too much. and the meme or the kind of quote that appears on the screen, it's like, you know, Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan talking to each other, and Billy Crystal, who's wearing a sweater, is like, and I start sweating like a pig. And like, that's what he's talking about with the dueling sweaters. So it's hard to explain here, but I will say it will give you several minutes of joy to go through this. So I highly recommend it.
Love that. Talk about the platinum jubilee. The only Jew Billy I want to pay attention to is Billy Crystal.
Yeah, it's fair. Well, I see what you did there.
All right. My spicy nugget comes from Paris. And this happened last week. A man wearing a wig to make himself look like an old woman, wheelchair bound, was detained after throwing a piece of cake at the Mona Lisa in protest of climate change.
I saw this.
And I just really appreciate like how French that method of protest is. Like we express ourselves only through pastries. Like you had it in the US, someone like self-immolating on the steps of the Supreme Court a month ago over climate change. And the French guy's like, you know what? I'm going to throw some cake at some glass in front of a painting.
Do we know what kind of cake it was?
I've not seen that reported.
Maybe German chocolate, because I don't think they would do it. They would waste actual French pastry.
What kind of cake are they supposed to be let to eat?
Well, I think the real question is what kind of cake would actually do something about climate change?
That's a good question.
That is the existential question.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Like a black forest seems appropriate.
Oh, that does seem appropriate. Yeah. No, I saw that. I'm glad you explained what it was, because I was just like, cake, Mona Lisa, what is happening? Yes.
Yeah. So for concerned listeners, it did the cake, as you know, the protester maybe should have expected, was stopped by the large glass case that completely encircles the painting. And so the quote from the Louvre was, so the Mona Lisa was recovered and her fame was all the greater.
That's brilliant.
So worry not. The planet's still fucked. Mona Lisa's fine.
I was about to ask about the planet. Did the protest work?
Not yet, but these things can have a long tail.
That's fair. Mike, great to see you, man.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabake. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Friday, June 10th, 2022 at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available every 2 to 4 weeks on all major podcast platforms through the summer of 2022. Thanks for listening.